Today, a dark shadow hangs over rate cut decisions now. Helen Guinness, Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one that is post covering finance and property news. Well, in this week's market update, we're going to focus on the path of interest rates, as over this past week, amidst the US election, we got a swathe of central bank rate decisions. The RBA held the cash rate on Tuesday, but the Fed, the Bank of England, Sweden's Riksbank, and the Hong Kong Monetary Authority all cut rates. While Donald Trump won't return to the White House for another 10 weeks or so, he's already casting a shadow over central banks. And with Trump 2.0 expected to boost growth and risk returning inflation, actually, there was a reasonable speculation that the Fed might not cut rates at all, or at least hint heavily that it would pause at next month's meeting. Certainly, some economists now expect fewer rate cuts from the Fed next year, as trade tariffs may boost US inflation. And that could reshape the easing path for central banks around the world and add currency pressure on emerging markets. For example, it's quite possible that a global trade war triggered by Donald Trump's proposed tariffs would push up the price of goods around the world, putting pressure on the RBA to deliver further interest rate increases and potentially wiping around $12 billion off mining exports, given that Trump could slug China with a 60% tariff and impose a 10 to 20% tariff on other countries, including Australia, as demand for iron ore would fall as the Chinese economy faltered. Treasury analysis showed that a $10 US a ton drop on iron ore prices relates to an annual $2.4 billion hit to government revenue. NAB's CEO Andrew Irvine said that he was worried a trade war would erupt between the US and China, as the RBA Assistant Governor Christopher Kent warned that there could be an adverse effect on the local currency, though, as Governor Michelle Bullock said in Senate estimates, it was hard to estimate, as we don't know how big and who they'll be applied to. Because it was unclear how China would respond to higher US tariffs, Dr. Kent said it would be difficult to model the effect of Trump's proposals on the Australian economy.
So the markets had been reacting ahead of the election and making a prediction that Trump may win the election. And then with confirmation of that overnight, they moved further in ways that you would anticipate. So higher US deficits through tax cuts in the US are in prospect. And one of the things that means is probably higher long-term interest rates in the US and higher inflation in the US. And quite possibly higher growth for a time. And because the US is such an important source of funding and the demand by the US government for borrowing is substantial, that'll have upward effects on global interest rates. It's also pushing the US dollar up and other currencies down, but I would note other currencies have fallen by more than the Australian dollar in recent days. So on a trade-weighted basis, we aren't much changed in terms of our exchange rate. The other thing that's in prospect is tariffs, but as the Governor said, we just don't know how big and who they'll be applied to. By itself, though, those should push up the US dollar because US customers will be buying less goods from the rest of the world and they'll need less foreign exchange. But it means less demand by the US for global goods. So that's a sort of a negative for growth elsewhere, and that's why European markets, for example, in terms of their equity prices were down a little bit overnight because US tariffs on European markets will be poor for their economy at the margin. And then finally, the big concern is large tariffs on China, which may have an adverse effect on us. But as I said, our equity markets have moved up a little bit in response initially, and the Aussie dollar not much changed.
So is it right to characterise the RBA's position as of this morning as unclear in terms of what the United States election outcome means for inflation outlooks?
It hasn't. At this stage, we would be sticking with our inflation outlook and obviously as time moves on and the new administration takes up and starts working on its policies, it'll become clearer, and then we can start to think about what that means for us. But at the moment, it's as we released our forecasts last week, or this week, sorry, this week.
But Australia's economic output could fall between 0.8 and 1.5%, or around $20 billion, to $37 billion if Trump imposed a suite of his economic policies, including slashing America's 21% corporate tax rate to 15%, according to KPMG. Now, in the US, as expected, the Fed funds rate came down by 0.25%.
My colleagues and I remain squarely focused on achieving our dual mandate goals of maximum employment and stable prices for the benefit of the American people. The economy is strong overall and has made significant progress toward our goals over the past 2 years. The labor market has cooled from its formerly overheated state and remains solid. Inflation has eased substantially from a peak of 7% to 2.1% as of September. We are committed to maintaining our economy's strength by supporting maximum employment and returning inflation to our 2% goal. Today, the FOMC decided to take another step in reducing the degree of policy restraint by lowering our policy interest rate by a quarter percentage point. We continue to be confident that with an appropriate recalibration of our policy stance, strength in the economy and the labor market can be maintained, with inflation moving sustainably down to 2%. We also decided to continue to reduce our securities holdings.
But the bottom line is that the expected course of rates over the next year actually barely moved at all. This was not a meeting where the committee published a new dot plot of economic forecasts, and in the statement issued after Thursday's Fed meeting, policymakers no longer included a line about achieving greater confidence that inflation is moving sustainably towards 2%, although they noted it has made progress towards the central bank's goal. While some try to make something of this tweak, it's more about consistency of tone than something new, in my view. At Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell's subsequent press conference, his comments arguably made it a little easier not to go through with a cut next month. As has been generally expected, the Fed funds future still sees a cut around 71% probability. But there are two more inflation reports between now and then, and they will take prime importance. With no great shift from Powell, the equity market continued on its post-Trump rally to new highs, while bond yields reversed much of their move higher since the election. Despite the Fed funds cuts at the last two meetings, 10-year Treasury yields moved up, rising from as low as around 3.6% in mid-September. They were catapulted higher at first by key economic data that proved better than expected, and then by the so-called Trump trades, as the odds of his election seemingly improved. It was last at 4.308, off from highs of 4.5%. Powell brushed aside questions about whether the moves by effectively raising interest rates in financial system would alter the trajectory of its policy.
Sure. So let me say that in the near term, the election will have no effects on our policy decisions. As you know, many, many things affect the economy, and anyone who writes down forecasts in their job will tell you that the economy is quite difficult to forecast looking out past the very near term. Here, we don't know what the timing and substance of any policy changes will be. We therefore don't know what the effects on the economy would be, specifically whether and to what extent those policies would matter for the achievement of our goal variables, maximum employment and price stability. We don't guess, we don't speculate, and we don't assume. Now, just in principle, it's possible that any administration's policies or policies put in place by Congress could have economic effects that over time that would matter for our pursuit of our dual mandate goals. So we, along with countless other factors, forecasts of those economic effects would be included in our models of the economy and would be taken into account through that channel.
Chair Powell, Nick Timmeros from the Wall Street Journal. Roughly 1 year ago, when the 10-year Treasury was flirting with 5% and 30-year mortgage rates were near 8%, you noted how higher borrowing costs, if they were sustained, could weigh on economic activity. Given that you've said you believe policy is restrictive and the Fed is now dialing back that restriction, are the growth risks presented by higher U.S. Treasury yields today any different from those you identified 1 year ago when inflation was still meaningfully above your target?
So I would just say this. You know, we've watched the run-up in bond rates, and it's nowhere near where it was, of course, a year ago. I guess the long bond rates are well below that level. So we're watching that. Things have been moving around, and we'll see where they settle. I think it's too early to really say where they settle. Ultimately, I'm sure we've all read these decompositions of what, you know, and I certainly have, but it's not really our job to provide our specific decomposition. I will say, though, that it appears that the moves are not principally about higher inflation expectations. They're really about a sense of more a likelihood of stronger growth and perhaps less in the way of downside risks. So that's what they're about. You know, we do take financial conditions into account if they're persistent. And if they're material, then we'll certainly take them into account in our policy. But I would say we're not at that stage right now. It's just something that we're watching. And again, these things don't really have mainly to do with Fed policy, but to do with other factors in the economy.
If I could follow up, is the September SEP, are those rate projections still valid? Do they still seem relevant given where we are now?
You know, it's you get halfway through the cycle between the last set and the next set. I wouldn't want to comment one way or the other. You know, people are. Let's talk about the data we've gotten since the last meeting. So, in the main, the economic activity data have been stronger than expected. The NIPA revision was stronger. Certainly, the September employment report was stronger. The October report not stronger. Retail sales stronger. So overall, though, I think you take away a sense of some of the downside risks to economic activity having been diminished with the NIPA revisions in particular, and so overall feeling good about economic activity. So I think we would factor that in. At the same time, we got one inflation report which wasn't terrible, but it was a little higher than expected. So I think really the question is December, and you know by December we'll have more data. I guess one more employment report, two more inflation reports, and lots of other data, and you know we'll make a decision as we get to December.
We've watched the run-up in bond rates, and it's nowhere near where it was, of course, a year ago, Powell told reporters after the rate decision. So we're watching that. Things have been moving around, and we'll see them settle. I think it's too early to really say where they'll settle. Two-year yields, which are more closely tied and longer maturities to the outlook for central bank policy rates, finished on Friday at 4.25%. And actually, bond traders looking for Jerome Powell to reignite a rally came away disappointed after the Federal Reserve cut interest rates as expected, but gave little away about the path ahead. One other point of note was that Powell was firm on the fact that as the chair of the Fed, he could not be dismissed by Trump. It would, to quote, be against the law. Let's play that clip.
Victoria Guida with Politico. Some of the president-elect's advisors have suggested that you should resign. If he asked you to leave, would you go?
No.
Can you follow up on, do you think that legally you're not required to leave?
No.
To follow up on Victoria's question, do you believe the president has the power to fire or demote you, and has the Fed determined the legality of a president demoting at will any of the other governors with leadership positions?
Not permitted under the law.
Not what?
Not permitted under the law.
Thank you.
Trump, of course, is expected to push through higher tariffs, lower taxes, and loosen regulation, all of which could fan inflation by pouring fuel on an already strong economy. It would certainly drive up the deficit and test the market's ability to absorb a seemingly endless supply of treasuries. Powell underscored those deficit concerns, saying that the federal government's fiscal policy, even as it declined to comment on how Trump's plans may affect the outlook.
I just wanted to follow up on the discussion earlier on fiscal policy. Your predecessors, Greenspan and Volcker, spoke up loudly when they thought large budget deficits endangered financial, economic or financial stability. Will you do that too? And right now we're in a period of full employment. We have large budget deficits and debt at historic and historic highs that are and rising. Is that something you'd speak out against?
So, you know, I have said many times, no more, no less than what the predecessors you mentioned have said. And what that is that the U.S. fiscal, federal government's fiscal path, fiscal policy is on an unsustainable path. The level of our debt relative to the economy is not unsustainable. The path is unsustainable. And we see that in, you know, you've got a very large deficit at you're at full employment, and that's expected to continue. So it's important that we, you know, that to be dealt with. It is ultimately a threat to the economy. Now, I can say that. I don't have oversight. We don't have oversight over fiscal policy. I've said it on many occasions, just said it again.
The Fed chief also did little to provide clarity around the FOMC's next meeting in December, leaving that 70% chance still open. But traders have dialed back their expectations of how deeply the Fed will cut its benchmark rate next year, since a run of strong economic data and the election has altered the outlook. Swap traders see the Fed's target band, which was just low to 4.5 to 4.75%, falling to around 3.7% in a year's time. As recently as a month ago, the expected price was dropping to around 3%. With additional inflation and employment data in, the Fed went 25 basis points as expected, said Whitney Watson, global co-head and co-chief investment officer of Fixed Investment Income and Liquidity Solutions at Goldman Sachs. We expect the same to occur in December. However, stronger data and uncertainty over fiscal and trade policies means rising risks that the Fed may opt to slow the pace of easing. In the UK, the Bank of England cut by 25 basis points, or 0.25%, to 4.75%. That's the lowest point in more than a year. All but one member of the Monetary Policy Committee supported the cut.
Inflation has been close to our 2% target for more than half a year now. And today, we have been able to cut bank rate again by 0.25 percentage points to 4.75%. Chart one, it's just come up, shows the evolution of 12-month consumer price inflation, that's the purple line, over the past year. It's fallen a long way to an average of 2% over the past 5 months and 1.7% in the latest data, which were for September. This is 0.4 percentage points below our August projection, which is shown in orange, and around 1.5 percentage points below our projection from a year ago, which is the blue line. So the disinflationary process has progressed well, and indeed faster than we expected. Both oil and gas prices have been significantly lower than market pricing suggested a year ago, but the downside news to inflation over the year has also reflected lower than expected food, core goods, and services price inflation. Since August, services inflation has fallen quite sharply to 4.9% in September, 0.6 percentage points below the projection we made in August. Looking further ahead to the next 6 months, which is shown in the shaded area of chart two that's just come up, we expect consumer price inflation to rise somewhat as the drag from lower energy bills wanes, that's the orange bars, and the contribution of services price inflation comes to dominate, that's the yellow bars. It's encouraging that we can now move forward from a lower starting point, but services and price inflation remains elevated, and recent downside news has tended to be driven by more volatile components, such as airfares and accommodation. We still need to see services price inflation come down more broadly to keep headline consumer price inflation at the 2% target. Monetary policy has been guided by the need to squeeze remaining inflationary pressures out of the economy to achieve the 2% target sustainably. We have needed restrictive monetary policy to lean against domestic second-round effects from those global inflationary shocks. We now face the question of whether the remaining domestic inflationary pressure, for instance, manifest in services price inflation and pay growth, will dissipate naturally now that the global shocks initially driving up inflation have unwound, or whether achieving this disinflation will require a period of economic slack in the UK economy. Alternatively, are we experiencing sustained changes in the structure of the economy with longer-lasting effects on inflationary pressures? These have become important cases in the MPC's deliberations. As policymakers, we can think that all three cases are of relevance, albeit to different degrees. Now, the forecast that we publish in the Monetary Policy Report today is based on the second case. In the projection, second-round effects on domestic prices and wages are expected to take somewhat longer to unwind than they did to emerge. But a margin of slack emerging over the forecast period is sufficient to ensure that consumer price inflation falls back to the 2% target in the medium term. And this is shown in chart 3. The blue line is the projection for consumer price inflation, conditional on the 15-day average of the market-implied path for interest rates to the 29th of October. That's our usual convention. Headline inflation increases to around 2.75% by the second half of next year before falling back to around the 2% target over the medium term.
Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey said it was likely that interest rates will continue to fall gradually from here, but added inflation needs to stay close to the 2% target and that rates won't necessarily be as low as expected earlier. And you noted that last week's budget in the UK has added to inflationary pressure, as the new quarterly forecast showed a 0.3% extra inflation next year. If the government was to, for the first time, actually go through with a planned rise in fuel duty, which is the official but never implied policy, then in 2026 it could add 0.5% to inflation. This is because the budget boosts growth up front, and it also means the forecast for unemployment at the end of next year to be lower, not 4.7%, but instead 4.1%. But it does mean it will take an extra year for inflation to go below target, and as a result of that, December looks to be heading for a hold. Bailey cautioned, we need to make sure inflation stays close to target, but we can't cut interest rates too quickly or by too much. This week's cut should translate into lowering borrowing costs, though only the tracker mortgage customers are guaranteed to see their payments go down. There's around 629,000 homeowners with a base rate tracker mortgage and around 693,000 borrowers whose monthly payments are linked to their lender's standard variable rate. But almost 7 million of the UK's 8.4 million existing residential mortgages are on a fixed rate, so 82% of people with a home loan won't see any beneficial change. So some of those fixed rate mortgage holders will need to consider their options over the next few months because their current deal will be coming to an end. And on Thursday, the average new two-year fixed rate mortgage deal had nudged up slightly to 5.42%, while the average five-year deal was up to 5.13%. As with mortgage rates, the returns on savings are generally not entirely tied to the Bank of England base rate, but Thursday's rate reduction is likely to be passed on to many savers who have easy access accounts and others who do not have guaranteed interest rates. The top paying easy access accounts are still paying around 5%, but those deals may not hang around for very long. The Hong Kong Monetary Authority cut its base rate interest rate after the Federal Reserve eased policy, though relief may be limited as the risks of potentially inflationary policies in the US under Donald Trump are set to pare back the easing path. The HKMA lowered rates by a quarter percentage point to 5% on Friday in a move that should bolster an economy struggling with weak spending. While the cut may help lower borrowing costs, the future pace of easing remains unclear, especially after the re-election of Trump as US president. He's vowed steep tariffs on imports that could keep inflation in the world's biggest economy higher for longer. The pace of future rate cuts remains uncertain. The city's de facto central bank said in a statement, adding that monetary policies across the major economies are not entirely in sync. Officials are closely monitoring risks of global financial market volatility, the statement added. Economists at Standard Chartered and Macquarie said China's growth would suffer a hit of as much as 2 percentage points should Trump follow through on his campaign vow to raise tariffs on Chinese goods to that 6% level. Meantime, Chinese regulators told the nation's banks to lower the rates they pay on deposits from other financial institutions to free up funds to boost the economy after authorities announced a total 10 trillion yuan program to refinance local government debt. Investors weren't impressed with the latest attempts to support the economy. The yuan sunk by as much as 0.6% in offshore trading, pulling its Asian peers, such as the Australian and New Zealand dollars, weaker. China's 10-year bond yield edged as low as 2.08%, a level unseen since September. The news also sent ripples to global markets, causing declines in oil and iron ore prices, reflecting worries that a protracted downturn in the world's number two economy will cut demand for key commodities. The debt swap quantity and time period suggests that the China government is keeping some stimulus gunpowder dry ahead of the Trump administration next year, said Gary Tan, a portfolio manager at Allspring Global Investments. We expect more follow-up policies to be announced. China will raise local government's debt ceiling to 35.52 trillion yuan, which will allow them to issue 6 trillion yuan in additional special bonds over 3 years to swap hidden debt, according to reports on Friday. Authorities said later local government will be able to tap another total of 4 trillion yuan in a new special local bond quota over 5 years for the same purpose. The plan to defuse local government debt, long considered a time bomb in the Chinese financial system, came after a week-long meeting of the country's top legislators that concluded after the US presidential election and Federal Reserve's latest policy meetings. The plan, approved by the Standing Committee of the National People's Congress, is close to the upper range of forecasts by most economists as China seeks to curb financial risks and shock growth. It's the first time since 2015 that authorities raised the debt ceiling for local governments in the middle of a year. Investors had hoped for the high-level gathering to also roll out potential fiscal spending to counter the threat of tariffs under a second Donald Trump presidency. New stimulus measures may renew optimism that emerged on Thursday after October's robust exports helped offset concerns over slow investment growth and weak consumption. Elsewhere, Sweden's Riksbank on Thursday cut its key rate by 50 basis points to 2.75% as anticipated and flagged another reduction in December if the economic and inflation outlooks remain unchanged. The Reserve Bank of New Zealand painted a bleak economic picture on Tuesday's financial stability report with inflation within its 1 to 3% target range, and it's set to continue with rate cuts at a fairly aggressive pace. The Reserve Bank of New Zealand has cut rates by 75 basis points so far this cycle, and markets are fully pricing a 50 basis point easing at its November meeting, and they see a reasonable chance of another move in February. In October, the Bank of Canada cut rates by a bigger than expected 50 basis points to 3.75% as inflation eased below its 2% target and the economy weakened. The Bank of Canada is tipped to cut rates again in December, with traders attaching almost 50% probability of another half-point move. So all up, the level of uncertainty ahead has been amplified by the Trump victory, and the consequences will spill over into other markets. But we can expect higher interest rates in the months ahead, which is not good for those holding on by the skin of their teeth. This is going to get messy. And quickly, markets were up again on Friday. At the close in New York, the Dow Jones rose 0.63%, tis a new all-time high, while the S&P 500 index added 0.3%, again to a high, and the Nasdaq Composite also was up 0.02%. The best performer of the session on the Dow was Salesforce, which rose 3.31%, while Amazon was down 0.88%. Banks did well this week on the expectation of stronger growth and higher interest rates, and importantly, less regulation under Trump. JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, and Citi all benefited from the election news. The volatility index was down 0.13% to 14.94. That's a new one-month low. And gold futures for December delivery was down to $2,691 a troy ounce. And elsewhere in commodities trading, crude oil for delivery in December fell 2.54% to hit $70.43 a barrel, while the January Brent contract fell to $73.99 a barrel. The euro-US dollar was down 0.83% to 1.0719, while the US dollar-Japanese yen fell about 0.2% to 152.63. And the US dollar futures index was up 0.5% to 104.96. So the mighty US dollar rules. Now on Friday, Australian shares tracked a positive lead from Wall Street as expectations of low interest rates and hopes for more stimulus out of China lifted sentiment for risk assets. The ASX 200 rallied 0.8% or 68 points to 8,295. That's less than 100 points away from a record high that was set last month. On the week, the index added 2.2%. That's the best week since mid-August. All 11 sectors ended in the green except energy as oil prices retreated. Tech leapt 1.8% as family app Life360 jumped 4.4% to a fresh high of $23.79 after UBS substantially lifted its US share price target. Commonwealth Bank also scaled a new high, adding 1.4% to close at a record peak of $149.56. The other major banks rallied, with Westpac up 2% to $30.14. ANZ advanced 1.3% despite reporting lower net profits in the fiscal year 2024. ANZ Chief Executive Shayne Elliott said competition in the banking sector remained intense. And NAB was up to $39.65 despite reporting rising bad debts. Hopes of new stimulus measures in China buoyed iron ore stocks. Mining heavyweight BHP rose 1% to $43.40, and Rio Tinto added 1.4% to $123.11. Gold miners stormed back after a rebound in bullion prices overnight on Thursday, with Bellevue Gold up by more than 3% and De Grey Mining up 2.6%. Biotech Neuren Pharmaceuticals was the top gainer on the index, up 15% to $16.57 after reporting strong US sales of its Daybue drug. At the other end of the table, though, Afterpay owner Block Inc. was the biggest laggard, down 7.2% to $111.75 after its September quarter profit and user volumes missed market expectations. Shares in Mayne Pharma jumped 15% to $5.10 after the company confirmed reports in the AFR that Jefferies Australia had been marketing the $376 million company to prospective buyers. And in currencies, the Australian dollar added 1.4% since Monday in a tumultuous week when it plumbed a three-month low of 65.1 cents on news of a Donald Trump's election victory before rebounding to 66.51 cents on hopes of fresh China stimulus. It was last at 65.85 cents and it was at 50.96 cents against the British pound. Finally, Bitcoin was also trading at record highs of 76,608, as many believe Trump will be positive for crypto again with less regulation. Plus, Tom Lee of Fundstrat said that Bitcoin could help solve the US budget deficit in a recent CNBC interview. Lee suggested that if the cryptocurrency is added to the list of reserve assets, it could help offset some of the nation's massive $36 trillion debt because of its potential to appreciate in value. Of course, everybody expects the debt to rise even higher under Trump. He also pointed out that traditional ways of reducing the deficit, such as changing tax policy or cutting spending, may not be enough on their own in the current economy. Therefore, Bitcoin could be a useful asset for the US Treasury and help manage the debt. Well, Peter Schiff, a vocal critic of Bitcoin, questioned the idea of cryptocurrency serving as part of the US Strategic Reserve, calling the idea a ridiculous plan. In his view, such a move would be ineffective and problematic, primarily due to Bitcoin's unstable volatility and potential impact on market stability. He highlighted the liquidity risks, noting that if the US held a significant amount of Bitcoin, any attempt to sell could easily trigger a market crash, rendering the reserve immediately ineffective. Such a scenario, according to Schiff, would defeat the purpose of a strategic asset intended to stabilize or enhance fiscal resilience. And he argued that Bitcoin's volatility and illiquidity made it unsuitable as a serious reserve asset, and cautioned against what he sees as misplaced optimism about its use by governments. So all up, over the next few weeks, markets will remain volatile as Trump 2.0 emerges and policies start crystallizing. In the short term, not much may change, but longer term, who knows? But I think we can be certain that interest rates and inflation will be higher ahead, and this will mean maintaining significant pressure on many households, even as markets peak higher. So it's a strange and disjointed world, and, well, the risks are rising. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.